Go right ahead.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, for that very eloquent address.
You could make the back of a cornflakes packet sound eloquent, you know.
You gave a wonderful advertisement for the Joint Committee for Human Rights. But do you think that, in general, the human rights environment needs to do more to advertise itself? Human rights often gets a very bad press, often isn't discussed in a knowledgeable way, or often is misconstrued in the media, for example. Do you think that there's something that people who are involved in human rights need to do in order to help change that?
I do think so. I think it is a very natural phenomenon that people in the third sector, hugely committed to and engaged in their particular campaigns, will be focused on the production of the next leaflet, the drawing up of the briefing document, the submission to a consultation, all of which are absolutely workaday activities which they have to undertake, and if they didn't, they wouldn't be effective. I myself think it's important as well to try to find time, not just to channel views upwards to government and parliament, but to spread opinion of an informed kind that human rights activists hold outwards and wider. So my own view is that every opportunity should be taken by people engaged in important human rights work to get into substantial organizations which can hear their messages. So, as I say, subject to the limitations and constraints upon resources, engagement with schools is important. Engagement with further and higher education institutions is important. Engagement, even, if I may say so, with universities of the third age for the older members of the population is important. Because if you just take that, you know, you'd say on the whole, I think the evidence shows that although the population across the UK is pro the equal marriage bill, there are differences between age groups, and older voters tend to be less supportive than younger people. But if you go into some of those organisations, you can often break down the barriers. I mean, certainly on the age of consent, I found, and increasingly on other LGBT issues I found in my local Conservative Party before I became Speaker, that there was some understanding, because, of course, if you're mixing with people in their 50s and 60s, the chances are some of them will have children who are gay or lesbian or bisexual or even transgendered. Some of them will have grandchildren in that situation. They may speak up and out, or they may, as happened to me in my constituency, simply approach me privately or write to me and say, we're with you. I remember a couple back in 2000 who wrote to me to say, you know, as you know, John, we have a son and a daughter. Our son knew from the age of 13 that he was gay, and we knew he was gay, and we love him nonetheless for that, and we think that you are right to come to the conclusion that there's absolutely no cause or justification for the statutory differential. So I think you do have to reach outwards and use every opportunity you can to get into other organisations to make your case. And I do think, I don't really believe in historical inevitability, but I just think the sheer moral suasion that your arguments have, our arguments have, is such that over time we will win more and more people to our standard. And if it's of any encouragement, I found when I was a backbencher campaigning for LGBT equality that the forces of opposition were becoming more angry but also more demoralised. They knew that they were losing. Now, I know there was still a substantial vote against the Equal Marriage Bill in Parliament, but think about the vote in favour in the UK. You know, it was an absolutely thumping majority. That bill will become law.
It's radical transformation in culture, isn't it? It really is. On that point about human rights, the media is a bit of an issue here as well, because, you know, in some places within the media, the phrase human rights only seems to appear as a slur, as an insult. I mean, in some tabloids that shall remain, the Daily Mail, for example.
I noticed that you didn't refer to a newspaper.
Take that as an answer, yeah.
Your choice of language is wise. No, no, I mean, you're right. You know, there are sections of the media that remain hostile. I mean, can you
convert those sections of the media. I mean, probably over a period, quite a long period, they'll move on to other terrain.
Yeah.
They won't be able to go on about the subject forever. But on the whole, I tend to feel that, let me put it this way, you should try to fight on the ground where you're strongest, not on the ground where you're weakest. If, in other words, your arguments are basically compelling and morally strong, and if you sense that you have and increasingly will have more people on your side than not, then try to invoke, where you can, public opinion in your support. I don't myself think it's worth spending a lot of time trying to win over organs that are deeply opposed. It's a bit like in campaigning. I say to the elected politicians amongst you, when you think about it, the purpose of campaigning isn't principally to convert people. The purpose of campaigning is to rally those who are with you and perhaps to try to persuade off the fence those who are wavering, those who are in the middle, those who haven't committed. If in the course of your activity, through the sheer force of your personality or the effectiveness of your contribution as a local MP or councillor, you are able to win over converts, fine, but that's not the main purpose of the activity. So I would say, you know, it's probably not worth spending a huge amount of time trying to convert the Daily Mail. I think you just work around them, you know, and they will continue to make raucous noises in the background. And of course, they speak with all the aggressive self-confidence born of complete ignorance. What's new?
Can you speak without a soundbite? I mean, you do deliver perfectly formed soundbites on a regular basis. I think you've got the mic, and then we move across as well. Thank you.
Well, again, I'd like to echo the thanks that have been put forward, Mr. Speaker, for a very admirable defence that you've set out here this evening. You did, of course, defend the proposition that LGBT rights are indeed human rights. And what would you say to those who are regrettably rather common in this part of the world who don't accept the legitimacy of human rights as a narrative? I know you sort of touched on it already, but do you believe there is anything that can be said to people who say they don't accept human rights as a way of looking at the world?
I suppose I would start by asking people who deny either the authenticity of claims to such rights or the legitimacy of their possession to imagine how they would feel if they were not in their position, but in either yours personally or that of LGBT people that you know. Because after all, you know, a key principle of religion is do as you would be done by, treat others as you would wish to be treated yourself. And so it may not work, it may not be effective, it may not succeed, or at any rate not completely or everywhere or yet. But I think it is worth asking people who are strongly opposed to imagine themselves in the position of the person whose conduct or aspiration they're busily flaying. And I just am saddened when people are furiously and in some cases even violently opposed to equality, because I feel, well, of what are you afraid? You know, what is it that you think is going to damn our society that other people should be afforded equality and granted the fulfillment of their dreams? So I suppose I would simply say, talk people through. Andrew Muir very interestingly made the point to me earlier that often in his early weeks as mayor, and I think more widely in his time as candidate and councillor, he sought to deploy humour to make his case and to make himself more comfortable or to make people more comfortable with him. And, you know, that can often be quite effective. But I do feel that, you know, there's often a difference between a general view people have and the view they can have when they start to get to know members of the LGBT community. Mm. And they come over a period to realise that people in the LGBT community are not threatening, not seeking to impose anything. You know, you sometimes hear it said, oh, well, you know, the trouble with these people is, you know, they're trying to impose their views or their cultural norms on us. Actually, I would argue it's often the opposite that is the case. I mean, first of all, if you're going to talk about religious freedom, I think that there should be freedom for churches, including, frankly, the Church of England, or individual parishes, to conduct same-sex weddings if they so wish. But actually, when people say, oh, well, you know, my religious freedom's important, and I'm very opposed to equality on marriage or whatever it may be, actually, they don't really mean that they want religious freedom. What they really mean is that they want the right, enshrined or protected in law, to impose their views on other people. I'm not trying to impose my views on anyone. And my view is that the case, for example, for equal marriage would be morally as compelling, even if an opinion poll showed that very few people wanted to sign up to it. Actually, I think you'll find that lots and lots and lots of people will want to sign up to it. But even if it were numerically a minority product in the marketplace, so to speak, I still think that the case for it would stand on ethical grounds. So I think just argue by persuasion, make the case as often as you can. And already, of course, you're finding that there are religious people who will speak out in support. I very much respect the fact that Naomi is a person of faith. I think religion is quite important to her, but she has a commitment to this cause because she doesn't regard it as incompatible with her religious convictions. I met somebody the other day who came up to me at a breakfast in Parliament, sort of pretty well hijacked me, so to speak, before I'd even sat down, and proceeded to inveigh against the equal marriage legislation. And she said to me, Mr. Speaker, I am a prophet. The judgment of the Lord will be upon you. And I said, well, I'm happy to rest content with that.
Can't argue with that, really, affairs. Can you? Know,
it's quite difficult to argue, but you know, I said to her, well, she said, I'm religious.
Yeah.
Ah, but I'm religious and I'm against it. And I said, well, I understand that point of view. You do accept there are religious people who support the bill. You know what she said? Very few. And I said, well, the Bishop of Buckingham, I can tell you, is an enthusiastic supporter of equal marriage, to which there was no obvious answer. Our conversation was concluded.
Sorry. She probably wasn't an Anglican. You've got the mic.
Hello. Yes. Can you hear me? Like the previous two speakers, I'd like to thank you for coming and enjoyed your speech very much.
Thank you.
Just get that in. I was also at the Political Studies Association meeting last year when you were here. So,
are you an academic?
I'm an academic. Oh, right. Yeah.
Can you tell from the beard? Come on.
I was interested in your discussion, or you're talking about the single sex bill, the legislation, which was quite overwhelmingly passed. But there was about, 130 Conservatives voted against it because it was quite a very, very strong issue within the party. And I wonder whether wearing your Westminster Village hat and your position of observation from that, do you see this having a strong effect on the Conservative Party and driving it even further to a less tolerant, a more kind of repressive kind of party, with Cameron losing out and his relatively liberal position on this issue having a backlash against that, and then allied to the rise of UKIP on issues like immigration and Europe, that we have in the future a much, much more intolerant Conservative Party on not just this issue that we're discussing tonight, but on these other issues too, which cannot be good for UK politics. And also, just an observation, what's happening at present is you have, within the Conservative Party, you have a push for married people to have more favourable tax regimes, which I suspect, but I have no proof of this, but I suspect that a lot of the 130 people who voted against this bill would be sympathetic towards that policy, but would not be too sympathetic towards this marriage policy being extended to gay people as well. But I have no proof of that. So it's just an observation and a bit of a question.
Well, thank you very much. And do I think that the public and observable division. I'm not trying to make an issue of it. It's just a public and observable division within the Conservative Party on the same-sex marriage bill will cause the Conservative Party to become a less tolerant party or to move rightwards. My own view, actually, is no. These things often go in phases, but although the politics of the Conservative Party, it has to be said, is absolutely not a matter for me. I'm no longer a member of a political party because the Speaker of the House of Commons eschews party politics and resigns from party on election to office. I don't think that will be so. I made reference to the Prime Minister's very explicit and principled support for the same-sex marriage bill. Clearly he is effectively the sponsor of it. It has come from him. And although, of course, it is true that there has been a strong reaction within his party to it, not least from quite a few activists, I am convinced that the legislation will be on the statute book soon. It will become law. And I am convinced that in a few years' time it will cease to be a matter of any significant controversy at all. And I think that in the years to come, the great majority of people who want their party, the Conservative Party, to succeed, will recognise that there are lots and lots and lots of votes to be won in the centre ground of British politics, and that political parties that wish to win elections have to appeal to that territory. So leaving aside the ethical considerations, I think pragmatically, parties will chase the centre ground. On the issue of party members being against, I say in the politest possible way that although I accept that that is so, there are very considerable numbers of party members who are against. If you look at the evidence of public opinion as a whole, it is clearly strongly in support of marriage equality. So although I respect people's right to hold their view, and I accept that there are some Conservative Party members, I'm not talking about MPs particularly, but activists who genuinely feel that this issue is going to lose them huge numbers of votes and could threaten the result of the next election and so on, I genuinely think that their view is misplaced. I think that they're making the mistake of thinking that because they are very angry about something, most people are very angry about that thing. And that, you know, simply isn't the case. Just remind me, the second part was the observation.
Tax.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that is probably true. Look, the argument about having a tax advantage for married couples has been around for a little while.
What is it, £3 a week?
Something like that. I think what I would say to you is, these days I don't express a view about that subject in the public square because it is the subject of a row in a way that the same-sex marriage bill isn't between Conservatives and Labour. Therefore, I think a certain self-denying ordinance on my part is probably appropriate. However, when I was free to express a view on that matter in the past...
Oh, that's very good.
...and could be relied upon regularly and with force to do so, I did argue strongly against such special tax treatment on the grounds that I thought, first, pragmatically, it didn't make sense because I couldn't believe that people would get or stay married for such a modest fiscal incentive. And secondly, of course, the provision of public expenditure benefits or tax advantages is, in a sense, a zero-sum game. If one person benefits, then that money isn't available for another person. Now, I have not argued that view tonight because I think it's right that I should keep out of any argument between the political parties. But when I was a backbench member and had a view about that matter, that was my view, and I did frequently express it.
Wonderful. Yeah. Just before we come to the lady at the back, just on this point, it's really interesting about the middle ground in politics. Northern Ireland's just like any other political system. The middle ground's really important. And the middle ground here is changing in religious terms and political terms. The middle ground is changing on the issue of support for same-sex marriage as well. The polling suggests increasing numbers of people are supportive of marriage equality. Now, if you were a prophet, What would you say is likely to happen to, for example, the DUP in the next 10 to 15 years on this issue? Are we likely to see a pro-gay DUP within our lifetime? Because they're chasing the middle ground vote.
There I really feel I've just got to duck it, because I...
You've never commented on that before.
I mean, as you know, I've not commented on that before, so I can't refer you to some past doctrine that I've issued.
We won't hold you to it.
I mean, the truth of the matter is that I just don't know that party well enough. There was also an interesting point made in the first question from the floor, the woman who's no longer in her place, about...
He thinks it's the House of Commons now.
I know, we tend to say that in the House. Oh, the Honourable Gentleman, who sadly is no longer in his place, and therefore I'm now free to criticise, so to speak. I don't wish to criticise her at all. But she made the point about the courts being a protection where Parliament and the majority had not been. I didn't know whether she was suggesting just that the MLAs were on balance against, or whether it was her view, and I don't know whether it's your view that people in Northern Ireland, on the whole, are against. Because, you know, I said you're behind here where we are, but equally I was told before dinner that I think only about 11% of the population of Northern Ireland in one recent poll seemed much concerned about the possibility of equal marriage.
Whether they'd be uncomfortable if their MP was lesbian.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Sorry, thank you, Andrew. Whether they would be, not on the subject of equal marriage or gay marriage, but whether they would be uncomfortable with the idea that their MP was lesbian or gay, and apparently only 11% thought that they would be. So, you know, that does suggest, again, it may well be that public opinion, as opposed to party opinion, is nothing like so strenuously illiberal as has been thought. You know, quite what the future of individual parties might be, I think I ought to steer clear of that. Look, I always try to treat all of my parliamentary colleagues, you know, with courtesy, and I respect their rights, their point of view. I just feel that your cause is just, and over a period, over what period I can't say with confidence, but over a period, the movement will be in your direction. And do I think there will be fits and starts and movements backward? Actually, I don't. I think it will be a fairly straight path. I'm not quite sure how quick it will be, but I think opinion is going increasingly to move in a progressive direction on this matter and on a great many other human rights issues to boot.
Lady at the back, you've been really patient. Thank you so much.
No, but I just want to get your view that the current proposals, that if, go ahead, and I don't declare my medical history, it gives my partner, should she want to marry me, the right to divorce me.
Sorry, say it again a little bit louder.
The current proposals for the equal marriage, that if I don't declare my medical history, it will give my partner the right to divorce me.
Under the current proposals for equal marriage, if you don't declare your medical history, it will be your partner's right to divorce you.
Yep. What, that's the current state of the proposed UK law, you're saying?
Yeah.
I confess that's not something that I have focused on, to be honest, and so I don't seek to dismiss it. It's just not something that I have reflected on. Whether that feature of the legislation is something that is causing much attention...
This is the transsexual dimension to it, yes?
...provoking a desire for amendment,
yes, but not transsexual. I'm trans.
Trans, yeah.
I had a medical...
So there's an issue for trans people within this legislation.
Yes, there is.
Is there trans equality within equal marriage? Is that a fair question, yeah? Is there trans equality within equal marriage? That's the next big equality issue in this in this debate, isn't it? Trans people are often left out of this debate.
They are. And, you know, I confess when I gave the Kaleidoscope Trust lecture last year, somebody came up to me afterwards and said, well, you referred to Antee, but T didn't get much of a focus in what you said. And I do understand the concern that that can provoke. You know, I suppose, first of all, you make progress on these things only a certain amount of the time and at a certain pace. And secondly, I'm not sure always I found, you know, as much of an evidence base available to me as a layperson politician, you know, focusing on trans issues, you know, as I have found is available to me in focusing on the other parts of the equation. So, you know, rather than giving some shoot-from-the-hip reply to you, you know, I suppose I would simply say that, you know, I think that does bear reflection. It most certainly bears reflection, including by me. And, you know, is my belief in fairness and justice and equality for LGBT people, what I've said, LGBT, it is. If that involves a certain amount of thinking through, so far as transgender is concerned, well, I'm sure that that thought will be applied.
Yeah, I think it's a big issue for the media as well. I just don't think I think we're just dominated by ignorance about trans issues.
Yeah.
I think we're dominated by ignorance about trans issues within media coverage. And it's a big learning curve.
You know, so there's obviously some way to go there.
Kiernan.